This week's podcast is brought to you by West Baton Rouge. Come explore West Baton Rouge this spring and join in for the annual Kite Festival, April 27th through 28th. Visit westbatonrouge.net for more information.
You're listening to Louisiana Insider, a superlative guide to a great state's destinations, hosted by Errol Laborde, executive editor of Louisiana Life magazine.
It's a Louisiana song. My favorite melody is a Louisiana song, hearing it echo through the cypress tree.
40 years ago, this year was the World's Fair. Prior to that was almost 40 years of expectations for it. It was a big event coming to New Orleans, and it got a lot of fanfare, a lot of attention. And now each year the conversation begins. And, you know, when there's conversation about the World's Fair, there's usually three points to it. One, it was a financial failure. Two, the locals loved it. And three, like the ongoing conversation about, well, what are we getting from it? What are the residual benefits? And we still don't know that fully yet. Even though I think that they're going to be positive. So with me is Peggy Scott Laborde, who followed the fair, one as a kid, just hearing about it when she was growing up, but also at the time of the fair, she was working for WDSU-TV Channel 6, and she was the co-host of the weekend edition of the World's Fair, live from the World's Fair, which means she had to get up at some kind of god-awful time on Saturday and Sunday mornings to be down there. And then as the fair went on, she produced The Daily Show. Channel 6 had a daily show about the fair. So she saw a lot of it. And then in the capacity at at WYS, Public TV, she's done a documentary about the fair. And there's another one coming on this year with an updated version, which we'll talk about as well as the fair. So hi, Peggy.
Hello. Yeah,
first of all, you look familiar. I mean, have we met?
I am proud to also call myself Mrs. Errol Laborde.
Oh, so you're that blonde-haired woman that we see around now. Okay. I just want to be sure. Okay. Opening there of the fair was in May of 1984.
May 12th.
That would have been a Saturday, and you would have been there with Channel 6. Doing what TV6 is the fair, I think they call it. What do you remember of opening day?
Being a pretty day, but kind of hot. And what happened was the news director decided to put the different folks who were anchors, news anchors and reporters. And because I was doing TV6 of the fair, I was paired with Dan Milham, and we were all spaced around the fair. And it was a multi-hour program. It was very exciting. They had the opening ceremonies. And then they would cut to us, you know, a few times throughout that broadcast to talk about what was going on in our neck of the woods. May I just, if I could, set the stage about WDSU. It was pretty amazing because WDSU was the only TV station that had an actual facility at the fair. It was a glass enclosed studio facility within what we call then the Great Hall, which was part of the initial convention center. And it was right next to the Ochsner Heart, which was this huge, two or three story high heart, you know? So you couldn't miss it, but that was the Ochsner Pavilion. There were a lot of pavilions within, and the Louisiana Journey was also within the Morial Convention Center, I guess the first or second phase of it at that point.
So all of that was part of what is part of today's convention center and also part of the Riverwalk shopping complex. All that was built in preparation for the fair.
And that's part of a legacy too. Yes, absolutely. Some things were built to be permanent. Some were built to be temporary, because of budgetary purposes.
Now the first day, the attendance was good and it got a lot of national attention on the first day. It was like the lead story in the news. So attention and people, there was a lot of that the first day. Unfortunately, that didn't continue that way, that there was an attendance problem gradually, and then I guess the media attention waned, but we'll talk about that. But what were some of your favorite things to do and see at the fair?
Well, Pete Fountain had a place called Reunion Hall, and that was where sort of the spot for traditional jazz, and Pete played there a lot. Also, their menu was kind of New Orleans, typical New Orleans food, red beans and rice, and some gumbo and some of the staples. I thought that was really delightful. Visually, the Wonder Wall, which was, some folks called it a frozen parade. It was this amazing strip of paper mache. It was really designed to hide the power lines because basically it was covering the neutral, what we refer to in New Orleans, of course, as the neutral ground or median, along what would become known of as Convention Center Boulevard. And so you had the Blaine Curran Studios executed it, but it was designed by Perez and Associates and Charles Moore. But you had these, sculptures, these paper mache
And
sculptures.
Charles Moore was a very famous architect back then.
Yes, very.
Right.
In New Orleans, he's known for the Piazza, but he was an internationally famous architect. But there are a lot of classical images, sculptures. There were cherubs. There were these wire arches, and was very classically motivated, the motif. And then you had these giant urns, and a lot of these, if they look familiar, some of them who would had been used off of floats, Mardi Gras floats, because the Curran Studios was the decorator, if you will. But you also had a ham radio station operating out of that. You had booths, you had gift shops, all of these things along the Wonder Wall.
Now, there was also a monorail,
Yes,
which...
in terms of transportation, there was an actual working monorail. There was the gondola, officially known as the Mississippi Aerial River Transit, MART, but we knew it as the gondola. And for folks who aren't familiar with that kind of gondola, as opposed to the one in Venice, these were these, oh my goodness, what would you call them, E? Kind of like, they almost look like a Volkswagen, mini Volkswagen bugs, if you will. These cars, these enclosed cars, but you could certainly see out of them, that were strung almost like beads across the river, and you boarded them. It's something if if you're on a trip and you're going to a higher slope or almost a ski slope or something, you actually traveled along the river. I never did. You never did. We were not brave souls in
Well,
that
if it
respect.
would have been along the river, it'd be one thing. It was above the river.
It
Okay.
was above over the river.
It was like way above the river, right? And it was like baskets. I guess they'd seated maybe like four people, four
Yeah.
or five people, and they dangled across the river on the cable and then moved. Okay. And I remember being there, I think it was like the second day, and passing the spot where the gondola started its trip across the river, and it stopped. It was just, I don't know if it was stuck, but it was stopped. And I could see this guy in there in a gondola in the basket. I'm saying, this poor guy, I mean, he's just like stuck in a gondola across the Mississippi River. And who knows how long that gondola is going to hold. What if that happened? I mean, nothing bad happened. But that sight was all I needed for the rest of the fair. I never made it on the gondola.
Well, the other thing, and you're asking me about highlights, though, would be all the music stages. I believe there were over 10 stages, and they programmed 12 hours a day. And especially the Folklife Pavilion, where there was a lot of Cajun music and kind of indigenous music in this neighborhood. It was really like a series of neighborhoods that you could go to. One was Centennial Plaza, which was decorated to resemble the 1884 World's Fair, the main building of the 1884 Fair. There was this whole amusement area, Hus was the name of this German owned business that operated incredible. There was a Ferris wheel. There were lots of rides in that neck of the woods along. And of course, the international pavilions along the riverfront. You had Australia, you had Canada, and they came in a big way. There were 3D movies, there were IMAX movies. The Barge Kennedy, this was kind of intriguing. This was a smaller pavilion, if you will, was actually a working barge that was docked right along the riverfront, and that was the Corps of Engineers pavilion. And in that was the most amazing film, in which they did this like highly sped up, a sped up photography from the top of the Mississippi in Lake Itasca, up in Minnesota, all the way down, you know, to the end of the river near us. It was really something.
And it did, but, it did in 2 minutes, you know, from
in 2 minutes, right?
One of these high speed things, yeah.
Yeah, but and then there was the mascot, Seymour, S-A-E-Y-M-O-R-E, Seymour DeFair, and it was a pelican mascot. This guy who went around in the most remarkable pelican outfit, designed like a pelican, and he was the official, the ambassador, the official greeter.
And he wore a top hat and a vest, a very friendly looking.
There's lots of Seymour DeFair dolls around, even to this day.
Yeah. There have been two pelican mascots in our lifetime. The first was Seymour at the fair, who was a very friendly, lovable one. The second was when the basketball team changed its name to the Pelicans, and they came up with a pelican mascot costume, and it scared people. It really looked mean, including me. And it's fun. They had to modify it to make it a little bit more friendly looking. So actually, there have been three, and this is a more friendly. But it's too bad that Seymour, I think it's called Pierre for the the basketball team, never really got to know each other. There was the special places. There was the Italian village.
That was amazing. Joe Maselli spearheaded, the late, great Joe Maselli spearheaded that, local businessman. And he had been inspired by these tiny villages in Italy. And he tried to recreate sort of the town square of one of those. He actually had a specific village in mind. And it was really based on that. And so Brocato's was in there. You had pizza parlors, but you always had live entertainment. And that's where those sometimes New Orleanians have been blessed to see the flag throwers from Sansepolcro. They were in the Rex Parade last year, and they were also in performance at the Rex Ball. But those areas did really well financially and made money. I know not everybody did. One thing I wanted to also harken back to in terms of entertainment was the Liggett and Myers Quality Seal Amphitheater. And this was the most amazing open area performance space, seated right along the river, so you could be in your seat and looking out at the stage and behind the performer. And the performer, my goodness, could be Johnny Mathis. Bob Hope did a show from there. I remember interviewing Anne Murray. I mean, just a lot of people perform there. But in the background, you'd see at night, you'd see the boats on the barges going by. And, you know, there was talk of it making it permanent. And alas, that just didn't happen. But what a loss that, because there's really nothing of that scale like that along the river.
Yeah. And look at Mars. That's what the cigarette company
L&M.
Was.
L&M.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, okay. L&M, okay. And, yeah, I remember that really, people really liked that because it was a beautiful view. And you look at the performance and then beyond the performance, you look at the river and you see this traffic. You see some barges passing by or a... they didn't have cruise boats back then, but you might have seen a steamboat. It was nice. And I know there was a lot of sentiment to make it permanent. And I remember talking to one of the people involved, and he said it wasn't built to be a permanent structure. I mean, it didn't have the infrastructure to be permanent.
Well, what I have found out recently in doing kind of an updated edition, half-hour discussion program in addition to the documentary, is that it could have been. And so that's something that, I know there's lots of woulda and couldas, but that actually, my understanding is it could have been made permanent, but for different financial reasons and other reasons, they couldn't really do it. But another real highlight was every night there were fireworks, and sometimes there were extra special renditions of the fireworks too. And that's what was so important about the fair, especially working there. I mean, it was my neighborhood, but we would get the calendar of events each day. And so in addition to stages filled with different kinds of music, the Mississippi Pavilion might have a boat builder, you know, the Folklife Pavilion had those kinds of things in an ongoing basis, or they might have some other special entertainment. You might have special guests, Vanessa Williams, Esther Williams, who was the 1940s movie star, who was the big swimmer, okay? But Vanessa Williams at that point was Miss America. They were both guests at the fair. You just never knew who you were going to see. Dick Cavett, David Letterman. lots of folks at the fair, for sure. Lots of entertainment, always.
And who did not show up, and this was... an important precedent, was the president. The president was Ronald Reagan at the time. And usually every time there's been a World Fair in the United States, the president has gone, at least made an appearance. And the president of the United States did not come. There was some kind of attitude thing between the White House and the World's Fair. And it was Republican, and maybe they didn't buy into the cost of doing all this. The government in Louisiana with Edwin Edwards and, well, I guess David Treen at the beginning. And so, but anyway, there was a bit of hostility. So the United States government never really dealt in if it did another fair. Now, they did send a space shuttle there. No one that actually flew him. It was a past space shuttle, but you could have walked around and seen that. And so that was its participation.
Also, though, the Apollo 11, yes, indeed, you know, the men that went to the moon first, they were there for a special day, too. That was in front of that space shuttle was located in front of the U.S. Pavilion. And one of the really big days before the fair opened was the way that the shuttle was shuttled. It arrived on a barge. And what a view that was. What an amazing sight that was.
Yeah, imagine seeing that. And then, and even the Vatican pitched in with on this thing.
Yes, indeed. Now, there's good stories about the Vatican because and it was a really big effort by the Archdiocese and many members of the Catholic community. My understanding is originally they were going after, get this, the Shroud of Turin, okay? And for many reasons, that didn't happen. But the Vatican Museum, the Vatican, you know, from the Vatican, the official museum of the Vatican, lent the fair a very famous Caravaggio painting called The Entombment. The Entombment, it's, you know, Jesus coming off the cross. And it was just really, really magnificent. Now, the other thing is that Archbishop Hannon at the time invited the Pope, John Paul II, to come to the fair. And the Pope, and I love the way he had that access like that, of course. And the Pope said, thank you, but I really can't come right now. But as we all know, that a few years later in 1987, he did come to the fair. And he did come to New Orleans, rather. And so we had the papal visit just a few years after the fair itself. But that was an outgrowth of an initial invitation to the fair.
Yeah. And that was quite a contribution. And if I understand that the Italian government, which is ultimately, I guess, the possessor of all of these artifacts and things, was a little bit nervous about sending all this stuff to New Orleans, you know?
Uh-huh.
And so it took some persuasion to get these kinds of things to be sent here. There was also nearby the German village.
Yes.
And I mention that because from the German village came a piece of music that became legendary in New Orleans and is still performed today. And do you know that? What is that?
The Chicken Dance.
Chicken Dance, okay. That the German village started every night, I guess a few times a night, people started doing the chicken dance. And so by the time the festival, the fair was over, everybody knew how to do the chicken dance. And it became very, very popular and still is part of, I'm sure Deutsches Haus still does it and it's done around town.
Oh, cool. Popular, yeah. During Oktoberfest. I'm so glad you mentioned the German Beer Garden because that was part of a complex, is another wonderful residual effect of the fair. That was known of initially as, because remember, we're talking about a lot of this being in what we call the warehouse district today, not far from the river. That was the federal fiber mills. I mean, they actually, were making fabrics and milling and all that. And so that was converted by Press Kabakoff in Lester Kabakoff, Press's dad, eventually into apartments. But with the fair, they first utilized it for spaces for the fair. And within that building, it was pretty magical, was the home of the monorail at night. That's where the monorail would go. But also part of this really pretty large building was the German Beer Garden and the Folklife Pavilion too.
Yeah, and part of what
Jed's Lookout, which was a nightclub.
Yeah. Part of what the fair was trying to do, as all fairs try, all fairs try to do some sort of urban development in their community. And part of what it was trying to do was help develop that community around the side of the fair, which had been an industrial area. It had been shipping and a lot of warehouses and a lot of buildings, but there were buildings that were used for warehouses. As the nature of shipping and ports was changing, these buildings were coming, more available. And so they really did things like getting a fiber mill and converted it to luxury apartments, which I think still exists today. I mean, that was the first of luxury condos, the Federal Fiber Mills. And then there was a restaurant, which was like a little industrial restaurant nobody heard of, called Ernst Cafe, that became more like the epicenter for activity of people that were moving there. So a lot of things developed within that neighborhood.
Yeah, that would be technically right outside of what the perimeter of the fair was, but it was close by. And Ernst is still around today, a different ownership, but Ernst is on Lafayette Street. Lafayette Street, Julia Street, these were some of the side streets that you headed towards the fair. The entrances of the fair, there were two main entrances, but there were a lot of activity off also to the side. Something else either you and I have talked about is that even though with the moonwalk, and to a certain extent, of course, with the with Audubon Park, Orleanians had a view of the river, but not a really great view. And so that's something I know that you and I have discussed, that maybe for the first time, Orleanians were really getting a great view, and especially using it, along the side for leisure activity,
Yeah. Well, I always say that was what in 1718 that New Orleans was founded along the river. But it was in 1984 that New Orleanians discovered the river, okay? Because at that time it was open. I mean, you could have leisure, you could walk back and forth. It wasn't blocked by factories or warehouses. And so it was a real revelation that people walk along there and say, look at that, man, there's a river right there, and so that was important to it. Okay, so those are some of the good things. And there were a lot more. I mean, you can have a lot of memories, but the problem started fairly quickly. I remember that and people were critical of the Times-Picayune for doing this, but I think it was part of their job too. Every day they'd have a gauge on the front page. I mean, it was like a listing of what the attendance had been the day before and what it should have been, what the projected attendance should have been, and what the actual attendance was. So every day people could look and see that this thing was falling way short of attendance projections. And I think that, among other things, just kind of helped set the mood that there's a problem here on the river.
The whole, why did the fair fail financially? Well, it's very complicated, but I'm trying to give kind of a quickie version of this. But one thing is that, and we're not blaming anybody, but there were projections that had been made, okay, that 11 million vis 10 to 11 million visitors a year come to New Orleans, okay. Well, if and so somehow that got extrapolated to, well, that's maybe how many people are going to come to the fair. And so a part of the fair's budget was based on numbers like that. And if you're charging X amount of money per person, this is the money you're going to end up with. Okay, well, that only two-thirds of that projection happened. So you had that. But the bigger ones are also the relationship with the federal government. Remember that you had Knoxville just a few years earlier, too. And the federal government had gone into Knoxville, put up money in a big way. Also, there was a change in administrations, a Democratic versus federal, a federal government. Republican rather. They weren't as necessarily as interested in working with those things. Now, you had a very supportive governor. You had Governor Edwin Edwards, and the whole idea of this fair. And let's just go back to why do you do a fair? Is to spur the economy and especially tourism. Remember, we're coming out of an oil-based economy, and the goal was to try to diversify a little bit. So, very well-meaning people, Ed Stagg from the Council for a Better Louisiana, in as early as the 1970s, he was talking about we should be doing a fair. Coincidentally, 100 year, almost 100 years earlier, there had been a fair for the same reason. We're trying to get people to come to town. So that public-private partnership was a problem. And then, the city had certain expectations because everybody thought that, this was a cash cow. And so Mayor Morial at the time had the wanted of the fair to pay for the revitalization of the streets in the quarter. They knew that a lot of people were going to come to New Orleans and to the quarter. So that, you know, so in the fair ended up paying for those streets. Now, E, as you will attest to, you know, what is the outgrowth of what happened in the quarter? Of course, the French Quarter Festival, right? You know?
Yeah, well, that's a great story because there was so much. They had to redo the streets. So, like in 1982, 83, it was a big mess, just chopping up all the streets in the French Quarter, which was deadly for the businesses in the French Quarter. So they were complaining. And anytime businesses in the French Quarter complain, they get lots of attention. Businesses in the French Quarter and the police, they complain, they can get a lot of attention, all right? And including that of Mayor Dutch Morial, who met with him and said, look, bear with us, let's get this done. We need to do it. But after it's over, we'll create a festival. We'll create a French Quarter festival. And you know, it'll be a festival designed to attract locals to the French Quarter. It'll be free for people, and we'll really use it to promote the French Quarter. So the business really had no choice, so reluctantly, okay. But they did it, and Morial was true to his word. He turned the resources of city government into putting on this festival, which became the French Quarter Festival the next year. It was a huge success. And we've seen it's got more and more successful every year. And so that was one really good thing that came out of it. And now it's part of the bookends of the month of April, where you have the French Quarter Festival at the beginning of April, then the Jazz Fest at the end. So that was something that, you know, really important that developed.
Well, the other challenge is, once again, the expectations. A lot of people thought, well, the fair is going to make so much money, so we should be benefiting from, you know, the prospect of the fair making the money. And so there was a disagreement or maybe misunderstanding in terms of the taxes that were paid on the tickets. And so unfortunately, that ended up being a real dispute between the city and the fair. And so that also caused huge problems. And eventually, you know, the fair had to declare bankruptcy, which of course was not good PR. And so that kind of exacerbated things too.
You know, another thing, we, you know, we hear examples of like when there's a huge event in the community, that doesn't necessarily always attract people. Sometimes it distracts them. And we've heard examples of people who were thinking about maybe going to Paris this year. And then they hear, well, the Olympics is going to be in Paris in the summer. So they say, well, I don't know if I want to go to Paris at the same time the Olympics is there. All right. And so sometimes people don't want that other big event in the community. But also, that speaking of the Olympics, the same year was the Olympics in Los Angeles. Which drew, if people didn't want to see a big event, it drew a lot of them to the West Coast.
Also, Epcot, you know, which is like a permanent World's Fair, was also, you know, just recently opened. So you had a lot of competition, and you know, remember, you're going after like sponsorship dollars. On a much lighter note, let's talk, if you don't mind. I wanted to mention the food at the fair, okay? And in interviewing some local folks, Deacon John Moore, the wonderful, you know, rhythm and blues star that we love. He remembers having a Belgian waffle for the first time because there was a Belgian waffle concession. Also, the mango freeze, which is
I
now
think
in.
nobody in New Orleans, myself included, had heard of Belgian waffles at that time. I
Right.
think they introduced Belgian waffles to the United States.
Right. And there was a Japanese, in the Japanese pavilion, there was a Japanese restaurant, and many of us were having sushi for the first time. It's so funny because now we're so used to things like that. But that too, believe it or not, that was fairly novel. Mark Romick, who of course, you know, in many instances represents the tourism industry and works hard at New Orleans and Company, he taught and he worked at the fair. And so we do interview him. And he talked about, to me, a little known dish called a Petro. And there was a Petro booth, and that still exists, believe it or not, in other parts of the country. But what that was is, imagine a bag of Fritos. And doused on the bag of Fritos is chili. And that can be delicious in its own way, but he remembers being very, very fond of Petros. And oh, and Tropical Isle. Let me talk about that. Today we know of Tropical Isle, you know, a lot of the bars in the quarter, especially on Bourbon Street, is Tropical Isle. Well, it all started with their booth, with, you know, using fresh juices and blended right there with the daiquiris. That actually got its start at the fair. And so they were one of the businesses that did come out ahead at the fair.
No, not a lot of them did. After it closed, there was some. I remember there was an Australian bar called Sheila's. It was very, very popular,
Yeah.
and it stayed open for a while. People said, "Well, this would be a mainstay," but in the long run, it didn't last. But yeah, Tropical Isle did, and I guess a few other restaurants got their start at the World's Fair, though none really endured. Now you've, by the way, I'm talking to Peggy Scott Laborde, who's a producer for WYS TV. She was there at the fair, but she also has, let's talk a moment about the documentary. What is it that you have this year on the fair?
Okay. Well, first of all, we will be showing many times a 1 hour documentary looking back at the fair, which we did a while back, but it's still, all about what happened at the fair. Well, in conjunction with that, and before that airs each time, and you can go to WYS.org for the air dates and, some of this will be in our YouTube channel too, but we have a brand new half hour in which, in discussion, I interview Peter Spurney, who was, of course, in charge of the fair. He was the chief operating officer, general manager. So we have an updated interview with him. I just did that recently, but also interview our Mark Romig, as we just talked about, and Deacon John. So we're talking about all the different aspects of the fair, some of the famous people that they got to meet as well, but some shared collective memories for a lot of locals as well. But this will be on at least four, I mean, both shows will be on at least 4 or 5 times throughout May. And then much of it will be on our YouTube channel too.
You mentioned Peter Spurney. He was like the man. He was a professional known for promotions and doing these type of events. He got the job. It was a big job. I'm sure it was a big honor when he got it. But man, it turned bad in a hurry. There were all the financial problems, and he didn't even make it toward the end. They had somebody else that replaced him, and so it became a very, very bitter experience for him. But you've talked to him a couple of times, including in this
Oh,
documentary.
absolutely. Yeah, he's
So,
very proud of it. He's very
yeah.
proud of, what has happened, the transformation of the warehouse district, the revitalization of the river on that area. I mean, many, many things. Yeah. Oh, he is. I mean, and we're talking about somebody who really came to New Orleans with a lot of experience. It wasn't like he didn't know what he was doing, but there were these forces, as we just outlined, beyond his control in terms of the funding. But in terms of the show, and he's very proud of that too, as well as the vestiges, But it was a great show. There was always something wonderful going on. The look of it, the palette, so much of the decor, many of the decorations, the buildings were in a pastel palette, which was indeed inspired by New Orleans architecture. It was a classy place, and it was safe. It was easy to get to. People had fun. I mean, you could be there. It was your own little magic space,
That's the one thing. Yeah, it was fun. It was beautiful. I mean, just talking about it, I just think all these wonderful memories. But also, there was always that sword hanging over too.
Yeah, they didn't have parades. They used to have daily, nightly parades, like a mini Mardi Gras parade for a while too. It was very much part of the culture,
But all during the time, it was like, even in my own mind, I was thinking about this. Well, this is really wonderful. But okay, all right. I mean, that became part of the discussion. You just couldn't get away from that.
By the way, if there were some movies, they weren't famous movies, shot there. Also, there was, I think it's The Young and the Restless. There was a soap opera episode that was recorded there too. I mean, it was really fun because that gave it more exposure, which you had, you wanted to be aware of. But it was really a classy, fun, not snooty place. But if you wanted your quiet moment, as we said, you could go to the Vatican Pavilion. That was amazing what they were able to bring in. Also, there's a magnificent fountain by an artist named Maestrovich. And that very, very fortunately was saved. And it's in front of Notre Dame Seminary today. It's magnificent. It's called the Women of at the Well, the famous biblical story.
So, what's the future of that site now? We know that the International Pavilion was converted into a convention center and Riverwalk. I mean, this was really the impetus
Yeah.
for Riverwalk. In fact, I believe I'm right that part of the deal with the Rouse Company, not to be confused with the grocery store, but the American Development Company,
ROWSC, yes.
yeah, was that they would come, but the fair would develop their building for them, and then they and then it went there. And so, I mean, there's definitely some improvement. I mean, there's no doubt about it. But
Well, cruise ships also, that's where a lot, you know, a lot of cruise ships dock not too far from there too. But no, Riverwalk, you know, which is still evolving in its own right, but you know, the whole festival marketplace concept is changing as over the years. But no, to have that built out that way, you know, that was the China Pavilion, by the way. A lot of that was the China Pavilion and some other international pavilions. But that certainly that's part of it as well. But I mean, you know, if you look at the major vestiges, I mean, the convention center by far, and with its subsequent extensions, you know, I guess that would be the number one residual, but also the transformation of a neighborhood. That neighborhood, as you said, you know, was primarily industrial. Now it's primarily residential. And you also have Julia Street, the whole arts district. You know, with those galleries, that wasn't around. And sadly, that was a sort of an area, I hate to use that term, Skid Row, but that's what it used to be called, you know. And all of that is vastly changed too, you know, for the better in terms of more commercial activity as well.
Oh, for the longest period of time, the river end of Canal Street used to be a place where no respectable people wanted to go at night. I mean, it was like a dangerous place. Now you got the Ritz-Carlton and the Windsor Court and more hotels coming.
But, you know, back one more thing about the convention center. And, I mean, this is fact that the funding, which a lot of it was from the state, the funding for the initial layout of the convention center was very much facilitated in the legislature. It got through the legislature because of preparation for the fair. And something else we have not mentioned were all the hotel rooms. Over 25,000 new hotel rooms, the Sheraton, the Meridian, which is now the JW Marriott. You know, a lot of the newer hotels in New Orleans were based on the fact that, you know, everybody's got to have a deadline, right? The fair is coming. The fair is coming. The Windsor Court opened around the fair. So remember that too.
Yeah, there was a period of about a year or so when it seemed like there was a new hotel opening every day. I mean, it was like, man, where are we here? I mean, there was so much, and that was exciting. That was the period of anticipation of the fair, where you're hearing all these stories of what's going to be there. That was really exciting. And then when the fair started, it was exciting. But then after a month or so into the fair, when there was these problems, well, I don't know. Let's see how this works out. But then we're in this phase right now of the legacy of the fair, where we're seeing developing a little bit slower than you might have anticipated, but there are signs of development.
Well, you know, one thing that we all thought would work out one way and it worked out another way, but still, I mean, it's okay, was Fulton Street. Everybody kept talking about Fulton Street as the new entertainment district. There is a vibrancy to Fulton Street because of Harrah's primarily and the hotel, and you've got Grand Isle Grand Isle Restaurant and other activities along Fulton. But that, I don't think, quite panned out the way, you know, we wanted it. But it's a lot better than what it was. It was just a street, you know, with like warehouses. It was empty. It wasn't a people place. And certainly Fulton Street is certainly that.
And now that you mentioned, a big uncertainty at the time of the World's Fair was casino gambling. There was still the big debate. Do we want casino gambling in our community? And it was, you know, people said, the mafia is going to control it. You know, we don't want that, you know. And then finally it came. And then when it came in a big way with that Caesars building. I mean, which is really, I know some people don't like it. I think for a casino at the end of a commercial area, you know, I wouldn't want it in Lakeview or Mid-City, but at the foot of Canal Street, I think it's, I mean, it really blinks, you know. So but anyway, go ahead.
Well, I know, I just want to say just a few things. First of all, that Perez and Associates were the primary architects, and Alan Eskew was part of Perez, the late great Alan Eskew, part of Perez at the time. The whole look we should be very, very proud of. Also, there's some charming smaller exhibits there. You had the big, you know, pavilions, but you had some smaller things within the great hall. You had Louisiana Journey was a boat ride, you know, through Louisiana. Okay. Like, you know, that kind of boat ride with those rides kind of things. But also you had a reconstructed vintage Creole cottage within which the Preservation Resource Center did. You know, how wonderful is that? You also had an African-American exhibit called I've Known Rivers. As a matter of fact, Mrs. Sybil Morial was very much a part of that. It was right near the Mississippi Pavilion. But you also had an international sculpture competition. And so you had some sculptures. I mean, we should definitely point out that the theme, you know, lots of times these fairs have themes. And this one was fresh waters as a source of life, the resources of a source. It was all about water. Okay. And so this water sculpture competition, these beautiful water sculptures were dotted the fair site. You know, fresh water is a source of life. That's what it is, fresh waters. And so even today, when you do have fairs, which not so much in America because of the lack of our interest in federal governmental funding, but occasionally you do have fairs that pop up around the world, and most of them have a theme.
And there are fewer fairs around the world too. There's not as many as there used to be.
Very expensive too. You know, you used to have innovations, you used to have inventions, you know, on view at the fair. Today, it's really more about showing off, if you will, your country or your area, and also entertainment.
Yeah. I mean, people don't need to travel around halfway around the world to see a new invention. They could just turn on their TV or something like that.
The internet, of course.
So the mission of fairs has changed. And I think things like Disney World and those kind of things with the super theme park has also created some of that, that, you know, was just kind of replaced fair.
Peter Spurney told me that, you know, theme parks, especially today's theme parks, are very much outgrowth of the concept of World's Fairs. And, yeah. It, you know, and of course, a perfect example is Epcot. But Epcot was inspired, once again, Spurney told me this too, Walt Disney had actually been hired to erect pavilions at the New York World's Fair. And so in the 60s. And so out of that came later, you know, part of Disney World and Epcot.
I think most recent World's Fair have tended to be like in Asia. I don't remember anything recently in the United States. And I don't think anybody would go for it. I mean, if a governor or a mayor said, let's have a World's Fair, people would say, man, no, look what happened in New Orleans. Let's not do it.
Minnesota, believe it or not, Minnesota is actually trying to go after one, but I haven't heard too much more about that.
And even there, I suspect there'd be a lot of opposition. You know, I wouldn't want to be the guy trying to sell a World's Fair to people in Minneapolis. Okay, because I think that'd be pretty, anywhere you go, I think there'd be opposition to it just because.
Now, the other thing is, remember that this fair in New Orleans ran for 6 months. The New York World's Fair ran for 2 years. You know, so, you know, not every fair is equal in terms of those kinds of things, too.
And to this day, you can still see artifacts from the New York World's Fair. Like if you fly in, if you land either of the airports at LaGuardia, JFK, if you're going into town, you see some of the towers or something.
Well, Flushing Meadow, you still have that, you know, the earth, the sphere, okay, which was part of this giant, you know, yeah. rendition of the planet. And that's right near where the U.S. Open, of course, takes place.
Yeah. A final, I always want to end by telling the story because I thought it was a very moving story. And that was the closing night of the World's Fair. And there was a ceremony, it was going to be at the amphitheater, and people, you know, going to have some music, something like that. But at the time, the fair was just limping along, okay? Time, a lot of the leadership had left, a lot of the facilities had closed down, a lot of the politicians were staying away. I remember being there and sitting in the stands. And among the few politicians who showed up that night was Lindy Boggs, who's always respected for this, because with the governors and mayors and everybody else just stayed away, there was Lindy Boggs. And that same year, almost a few weeks before, there had been the closing of the Olympics in Los Angeles. And there was that famous scene of the closing ceremony of the Olympics where all the athletes, maybe hundreds of them on the field holding candles. And then, the song All Night Long, was that Jimmy Cliff who did that? No,
Lionel Richie.
Lionel Richie's All Night Long. It was a beautiful, beautiful shot. All these athletes on the field with the can, you know, and then that song, which is a beautiful song, you know, these athletes from all around the world singing All Night Long. And people were very, very impressed with that. And a lot of people watch it, just nationwide, because it's a big event. So for the closing, the World's Fair, in its own meager way, tried to recreate it. And I remember on the stage, there was Lindy Boggs, the World's Fair dancers, which might have been 10 people, in Seymour the Fair, and maybe a couple of other people. And they played on the, they didn't have a band, they just played on the PA system all night long. And they were swaying back and forth, and the crowd sang along with it. And it was very touching. It was sad because the crowd wasn't there, but at the same time, you knew the spirit was still there. And that was really the closing moments of the fair.
It was very dear. May I give you a quick PS about Lindy Boggs, the amazing Lindy Boggs, who was such an amazing congresswoman and community leader, you know, for so many years, and representative, of course, American to the papacy, you know, Vatican City. Peter Spurney, you know, I guess one of the things I really like about what I do is you're always learning about, you know, the past. And in talking more recently to Peter Spurney again, he said, you know, they were trying to go after sponsors. And he told me that, you know, he asked for the help of, you know, our congressmen and congresswomen. And Lindy Boggs actually went to Lee Iacocca, and it was only recently at that point that Chrysler got that, you know, federal governmental bailout. And so she felt very comfortable in going to Mr. Iacocca and saying, hey, would you consider, you know, we helped you, you know, would you please consider, you know, supporting the 1984 World's Fair? And there was a Chrysler Pavilion. And also they lent the use of a lot of cars in terms of transportation for a staff. But she, you know, she facilitated that big time.
Yeah, good for her. And anybody who knew her, she was a very mild, soft-spoken woman, but to wrestle Chrysler into putting up a pavilion, I mean, that kind of shows how much gumption she really had. So that was really good. So what we learned from the fair is that sometimes in life there are things for which there are high-end anticipation, and they don't always materialize as planned. But maybe in the long run, sometimes something good still comes out of it. It may be different than what was anticipated, but maybe at some point, and maybe it's a lesson we can all take with us, you know. So,
well, with it's a and being a community project, you know, I think it was really one of the feeling that we could all get together and say, hey, we've got this deadline, you know, we want to put on the best show and make things better in New Orleans, and look forward to receiving these visitors and be, you know, hospitable as New Orleans always is, but nothing like a deadline too.
So if anybody wants to see a World's Fair thing, go to WYS.org.
Well, for different air dates, a lot of it will be on our WYS YouTube. We have a lot of wonderful local content on the WYS YouTube channel. But for exact air dates and times of the new half-hour discussion program and the documentary, which they'll air next to each other, please go to WYS.org for details.
And the WYS, which is, for those of you out of town, this is public television in New Orleans.
The 12th oldest public TV station in the country, by the way, too.
Yeah, home of Sesame Street, among others.
And stepping out and informed sources, lots of local programs.
Has Seymour the Fair ever met Big Bird?
you know, that is such a good question. I do not know, but we were very, I still have my Seymour the Fair doll. I have a Seymour the Fair mug. A lot of Orleans still have a lot of World's Fair abilia.
Well, Mardi Gras, this past Mardi Gras, I saw this guy walking down the street dressed like Seymour the Fair. And no one understood why, what he was doing. I mean, there was nobody there who remembered the World's Fair, but he knew.
It was a well-done costume,
yeah,
too.
He knew, and he would be glad to tell anybody who wanted to know. Peggy, thank you very much. It's been great.
Thank you very much. A pleasure. Thanks. Bye.
Thanks for listening to Louisiana Insider. Subscribe, like, and rate our show where you listen to your podcasts, and follow us on social media at Louisiana Life Mag. Executive producer for Louisiana Insider is Kelly Massico, in cooperation with Louisiana Life magazine. For subscription information to Louisiana Life, call 504-828-1380. Our theme music was provided by Rich Collins. Hey, that's me. Join us again next week for more discoveries inside Louisiana.